I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Tea and Murder and Agatha Christie podcast. We're a part book club, part interview show, all Agatha Christie. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. We are currently between seasons, but we thought we'd give you a little treat because you've been so good. So we have our producer, Kate, with us today.
Hey.
Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Kate Kreshel is a part-time podcast marketer and producer and full-time marketing automation manager at Too Good To Go. She hails from Boston and moved to Copenhagen to study film in grad school. She has been in podcasting since 2017 when she quit her job as a TV analyst at Twitter, RIP, because she fell in love with radio. Same. When not working, she is attempting to train her adorable Boston Terrier puppy, Audie, who snores we've tried to edit out of Tea and Murder episodes to varying degrees of success. We love Audie, though. Welcome, Kate.
Thanks. Yes, apologies in advance for Audie, but he's in the other room today, so let's see.
He is, but he's so sweet, and we love Audie so much, and he's been just as big a part of this podcast as any of us, I think.
Aww. Yeah, I wish he could be on an episode.
I know. Well, he is on a lot of episodes.
He could tell us about which murder mystery is his favorite.
I feel like he's so cozy that
he
could choose any of them.
And that's true.
Yeah, he's just the coziest little pup. I'm so glad that Kate is here today because when Kate started producing this podcast, she had not read any Agatha Christie's excepting, and then there were none, which she did for a, third grade book report or something.
I'm really sorry to reveal that to you all, that I am not a huge Agatha Christie fan.
That's fine. You're a huge fan of podcasts, mm-hmm. and I think that's what's reflected the most in this podcast. You don't need to be a fan. I need to be a fan.
Yeah, that's true.
And you need to be a fan of me, which I think you are. So we are going to be talking about Kate reading her first Agatha Christie, and mm-hmm. I'm really excited.
Yeah,
it was
a thrill.
It was?
Yeah.
And you are a big reader outside of Agatha Christie. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you read in general?
Yeah. Both my parents are writers. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really it was sort of when I was growing up, you could go onto the third floor of our house and they just have a huge library and mm-hmm. I could just pick something and ask my parents, is this good? And then they would tell me about it. So I'd be like, aww. Yes, no. But I've fallen more into contemporary fiction is my favorite. So yeah. Ian McEwan, Alice Munro, Emily Sanjay, Emily St. John Mandel is my favorite author in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Station 11, if you've read it or seen the TV show, mm-hmm. highly recommended. Yeah, so older stuff and especially murder mysteries and that kind of thing hasn't really been my jam, even though I'm a huge true crime and podcast listener and I juicy, gory stuff on uh-huh. TV and film. But for some reason, I haven't gravitated towards crime fiction. I don't know. Huh. It's strange.
Interesting.
Yeah. I did read The Girl on the Train, though, like whipped through it in like 24 hours. And I was like, because I don't know, maybe I'm just like a book snob because of my parents. So I'm like, I don't know if I should buy this really, really best-selling crime fiction.
God, I don't know. You are a snob.
I know. Like, I have to read the literature. It's so dumb.
But, and you know what? I hear you. And I think that is a consistent kind of criticism of not only Christie, but of genre books in general, which is that they're not real literature. I really push back against that. I think they are literature. And I think they should, especially someone like Christie, who covers such a long period of time from the 20s all the way through to the late 60s, should really be looked at as like really quite interesting social literature.
Yeah.
So I hope that maybe this podcast has changed your mind a little bit.
It fully has. Okay. And I'm sorry for my snobbery.
No, I think being able to admit you're a snob is the first step to undoing the snobbery.
It's true.
Yeah. We're all snobs about certain things, right?
Yeah.
So you're the producer of Tea and Murder, which thank you for doing that, which longtime listeners will obviously know. And you've talked a little bit about your previous podcast production work in our producer episode in between seasons one and two.
Definitely go listen to that if you haven't.
Yes. And the listener Q&A. So tell me a little bit more about how you approach being a producer of a podcast. What does that mean?
Yeah. So I would say my role is a little bit atypical of what a producer typically would be. If you are working on a like highly produced podcast that has, you know, like well thought out storytelling and sort of like a lot of producer research and booking guests and figuring out like the sort of narrative arc of the story. If you're like, you know, working with journalists, for example, that's a lot more of like logistics and planning and then also thinking about how everything is going to come together. But since Becca is such an expert on Agatha Christie, you are the one who really like thinks about the guests, books them, does the pre-interviews. So for me, it's really about the hands-on work of being there during the recordings and then thinking afterwards, how can we sort of fit this all together so that it tells a good story?
Yeah. And Kate gives me the best post-show notes of anyone. So what is it like specifically producing a podcast where you're not necessarily like in the world of the podcast? So like you obviously know how to produce a podcast, but you don't know that much about Agatha Christie. What is that like?
Yeah. I would like to say that it's an advantage, but, I could be wrong on this. I think my reason is I do feel like it gives me a little bit more of the creative distance and a little bit more objectivity. I would like to think, I don't know about your,
I think that's right.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Because I feel like I can listen to when you guys are talking, when you have a guest on, and the points about the story that you're reading, I can sort of like pick up on the stuff that we can take a new angle on the next episode, right? So I can hear, okay, we've talked about this before. It's everyone has a new perspective, obviously, because every guest is different. But being able to zoom out and be like, okay, I just had an idea. What new type of guest could we get that like nobody has really thought about before on this podcast, so that we can sort of pull in new angles and differing topic areas? You know, there's a lot of talk on this podcast about character, story, plot, intrigue, like narrative devices, but like what other stuff that can we talk about when it comes to books?
And I will also say that you do a really good job of keeping me humble when it comes to, I obviously have some kind of bugbears that come up again and again, and Kate's been really good at saying like, you don't need to say the word pluck anymore.
You hate plucky people, those characters, the
plucky
women.
Everybody knows it, and I don't need to say it so much. So I appreciate that that help in terms of understanding the scope of all the episodes as opposed to focusing on each episode individually.
But I mean, having read this book now, and we can talk about like the details of it in a second, but it definitely has colored a lot more about what you have talked about with all of your guests, so that I now understand exactly what you mean when Poirot is very particular, for example. Or, you know, it's just a little bit more, I know how Christie can conserve words to really get to the essence of what she's conveying, and I'm just like blown away by her talent. That was new for me.
Oh my god, I'm so excited to talk about this with you. Okay, so you decided to read, or I suggested to you that you read The Murder of Roger Ackroyd over the winter holiday. What prompted your decision to read a Christie finally for this podcast?
I was like, it's about time. Come on. Like, if I'm really going to up my game and sort of make this podcast the best it can be, I can't really sit on the sidelines anymore, I feel. So it was, you had suggested this book, and it's actually perfect for me, and we can talk about why. But it was sort of like, what better way to start off our next season, season three, than with like a new, fresh take on what I can bring?
I love
to
that.
The season.
I'm so excited that you did this. I'm really grateful because I know holiday time is precious for all of us. So I appreciate that you took that time.
But it was cute because I was in a summer house with Winter, our producer, who's also my partner. Spoiler alert. And
spoilers for this episode.
And they were like doing a puzzle. Yeah. Actually, I don't know if you guys follow our Instagram, but they were sitting in the living room doing a puzzle that was with 90 clues about Agatha Christie in the puzzle.
I know. You sent me a little video and I was so excited to see it.
And I was sitting on the couch reading The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. And it was just like, this is amazing. This is perfect.
Yeah, I have to say, for two people who claim to not be big Agatha Christie fans, you did a lot of Agatha Christie stuff over your holiday. And I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. It was great.
Yeah. It's really like trickled down.
Thank you for bringing this into our lives.
Absolutely. No problem. So I'm going to do a little mini historical note about the murder of Roger Ackroyd so that we can dive into the book part. The Murder of Roger Ackroyd was published in 1926 after a previous serialization in the London Evening News throughout 1925, and it was titled Who Killed Ackroyd for that serialization. Hmm. It's the third Poirot novel, one of Christie's best critically received novels, if not the best, and as biographer Laura Thompson puts it, it rests upon the most elegant of all twists. Mm-hmm. And we will have spoilers for this.
Yes, you can't talk about this without
this
spoilers.
Is one of those you cannot talk about without spoilers, so there will be spoilers for The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. It was adapted by Michael Morton for the stage in 1928 under the name Alibi, making it actually the first adaptation of a Christie. And under the same name, it was also adapted to a film. It was the first sound film adapted of Christie's work in 1931, and that's now actually considered a lost film.
Oh, really?
It was. On a personal note, I love this book. It's the one that I always recommend to people that have not read a Christie, like as where to start, which is why I suggested it for you, Kate.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, so let's get started. Kate, can you give us a brief 1 minute or so synopsis of The Murder of Roger Ackroyd?
I can.
Yes.
And it was great hearing that historical note because I purposely didn't read anything
because
I wanted to go into it blind. So it's really interesting to put it into context.
Great.
Okay, but I wrote it down because the plot is like a little bit, like there's a lot of like front heavy details in the beginning of the book that so I needed to write it down basically.
Okay.
So we find ourselves in King's Abbot, a typical Christie town where there's gossip and an upstairs/downstairs class vibes. We're introduced to our narrator, Dr. James Shepherd, the local physician who lives with his sister, Caroline, who has all the inside scoops.
Yeah, she's a real gossip.
Yeah. And he proclaims that he's retelling this story as a manuscript for a book. We hear of the death a year prior of a Mr. Ferrars and possible poisoning by his wife, who has now died by suicide. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Shepherd is called to Fernley Park to talk to Roger Ackroyd, our titular character, about the ordeal. While he's there, Ackroyd receives a letter from the late Mrs. Ferrars posted before her death that she's been blackmailed about the poisoning and that she'll reveal the blackmailer in 24 hours. Roger Ackroyd asks Shepherd to leave, and what happens next? You guessed it. Dr. Shepherd receives a phone call at home and rushes back to Fernley Park, where it's been discovered that Ackroyd has been murdered with a Tunisian dagger in his study. It's a closed quarters whodunit where few people can and have motive to be the murderer, including Ackroyd's suspicious stepson Ralph and several staff. Dr. Shepherd is one of the last to see Ackroyd alive, so he takes it upon himself to help out with the investigation.
It's so nice of him.
He just happens to be neighbors with a man he believes is a retired hairdresser, which, side note, LOL.
Lol, so funny.
So funny. Who turns out to be our own Poirot. And when the local inspector is proven competent, as is per usual in Christie, I've learned, Poirot does his very typical Poirot thing of using his little gray cells to solve the case, which he does in a big reveal at Fernley Park that you probably won't see coming. It is at Fernley Park he does it, right?
So, yeah. That was perfect.
A little bit long, but you need the details.
You need all the details. That was perfect. So you told me that you guessed the ending of this book, which no one has ever said to me before.
Really?
Yeah, this is one of Christie's best twists. Like, this is kind of the original great twist that changed a lot of mystery novels. Mm-hmm. How did you guess?
Yeah.
I mean, we're just... And also, will I say, did that ruin the rest of the book for you, like, once you had guessed?
Mm-hmm. We're getting right into it.
Yeah.
I feel like we can talk about the other elements of the book, but this one is the most, it sticks out the most for
me.
It didn't ruin it. No.
Okay.
But my first clue actually was the blurb of the book said, this is the book that changed murder mysteries forever.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, what does this mean? Because I know the Mousetrap also because you and I went to go see it.
Yep.
And I was like, that's a big twist. So I was kind of already thinking, what kind of twist could there be?
Mm.
So that was my first clue.
And it's a similar twist to the Mousetrap.
Exactly. It is. Mm-hmm. And then, so another clue was when it's revealed that Shepard goes to the Three Boars to tell Ralph that he's a suspect, my brain was like, why did he leave this detail out in his recounting? That was the first like, because like it was all chronological into that up to that point. And then there was a moment where he was like, oh, actually, Shepard had been to the Three Boars and like alerted Ralph that like they were looking for him.
It opens up the idea of that he's maybe not so reliable.
Correct. Right. Yes. But actually it was really Caroline that clued me in.
She is such a great character.
Yeah, she's so good. And I'll tell you why. There's several moments.
Okay.
First, Poirot visits her to ask about Shepard's patients. And then there's this deal about Miss Russell coming for her bad knee. And then there's that whole thing about the like her asking about the poisoning.
Yeah.
And Shepard also kind of mysteriously like scoots around the issue. He doesn't really like dwell on it when he's retelling this. And I'm like, that's like poisoning. Like, obviously, it's a big thing about this story. And then there's also this like sort of side comment where Caroline just casually mentions that he doesn't think Shepard can look after himself.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay.
Right.
So that's like, I didn't really guess it until maybe 2/3 of the way through.
Okay.
And I was like, it has to be him.
Okay. It has to be him, but maybe.
Yes. I was still but I didn't think it was Ralph. I was like, he's too much of a, you know.
He's too much of a red herring.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. He's like a vermilion herring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Almost like a MacGuffin. Right. If you know about that concept.
You want to explain it?
Yes.
To listeners who don't know.
A MacGuffin is a film concept popularized by Hitchcock, where it's sort of like you plant a very obvious red herring clue at the beginning of the story to deter focus away from what you actually want to tell about. So it's sort of like you're guiding the audience in like sort of a detour so that you can like spend more time that's more interesting on like your main focus of the story. Yeah.
So speaking of film, you are a film expert. You have a degree in, what's the exact degree? Do you want to?
Film studies.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you told me about your take on this book, you mentioned how you love the unreliable narrator trope. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and how it's related to both film and this book?
Sure.
Well?
Yeah. I don't know. It's my favorite genre of film. I don't know why. It's like when you can't trust the person who tells you the story is like really interesting for my brain. I don't know. I just really like it. It keeps it moving.
Yeah.
This is also why like it didn't ruin the book for me. It was kind of a satisfaction that I could sort of like jump between, I'm just going along with the story, but I'm also trying to pick out the clues.
Right.
And it's just like a very nice, happy medium because it's also incredibly hard to do.
Right.
Yeah, it was just fascinating for me to read one of the first unreliable narrator mysteries, because again, the blurb says it was, it changed mysteries forever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just like I just not knowing the twist was a big deal and I didn't want to be jaded by anything like while I was reading it. So it was just super satisfying to be like, okay, this is unreliable. Anyway. But like I said, they're really hard to pull off, I think. It takes like a particular craft, really, to toe the line between, because you kind of have to like trust and distrust your narrator at the same time, right? You have to kind of keep the story flowing. You have to establish narrative authority and almost also a presumed audience who's like taking what you're telling at face value. But then you have to like slowly dismantle that relationship and that trust. And I just think also in film, it's really because you have an extra like medium, you have a visual aspect to it. So it's sort of, it gets even more complicated to sort of maintain, but then dismantle that trust through the audience and through a narrator. I think it just like can easily turn into a belabored like character study. And then it's just like, oh, kind of heavy, or it's kind of like gimmicky if you're not careful. So I guess in books, and one example would be Holden Caulfield of Catcher in the Rye. People love this narrator, even though he is sort of that like bumbling, naive, unreliable narrator trope. Mm-hmm. But I just find him incredibly irritating. And it's not that he as a character is irritating generally. And I think that's J.D. Salinger's like sort of point of it, right?
Yes. He's a teen. He's like a teen boy. They're meant to be irritating.
Exactly.
They just naturally are.
Even just like this, as I said, it felt belabored. Just come on with it, you know?
Interesting.
So he's just a little too one note.
Okay.
So that's sort of like what I feel about unreliable narrators generally, why I really like consuming stories that have them. But in terms of film, I would say the first like biggest example of it would be Citizen Kane. But this is 15 years before Citizen Kane, this book came out. So it's sort of like setting the stage even more. He's probably, Citizen Kane is maybe the most like shifting perspective classic that I can mention, where you have like three subjective characters who is recounting the life of a like sort of complicated famous man. And then you can also see it in the 1950 Japanese film Rashomon by Kurosawa. Have you seen that?
Yes, I have.
Yes. Yeah, which is about the murder of a samurai told from four different perspectives. So, yeah, in film, I think reliable narrators are also hard because if you have a main character sort of, like I said, visual perspective at the centerpiece, what you don't show is really crucial. So you kind of have to like drop hints using the form and story.
And other characters maybe sharing something or saying like, hey, what about...
So that's why I was really impressed also in this book, in the murder of Roger Ackroyd, because you only have the written page, So like kind of dropping those hints is even more subtle sometimes. So it was good. But more, I guess, like recent examples, if you want to hear recent examples of unreliable narrator films, Fight Club. Big one. There's like, and I think the way that that works is that there's two completely different actors playing, you know, this like guy with a split personality.
Which you don't even know until the end of the film, basically.
Sorry, another spoiler for Fight Club.
But spoilers like... for Fight Club, which if you haven't seen at this point, like, sorry about it. And it's also, I mean, it's not just a film, it's also a book.
Also, Usual Suspects, Shutter Island is a good
great
one.
Great twist with The Usual Suspects.
Yeah, really good. And even Forrest Gump, I was reading, could be considered one because he's like the sort of naive, rose-colored glasses kind of character who is telling a story that's much, much more like heavy and deep. That you are like taking from a sort of like almost infantile perspective.
Oh, that's interesting. I wouldn't consider that an unreliable narrator, but that makes sense. I guess because, there's kind of an objective truth and then there's his version of it, which is this very kind of sweet retelling, almost fairy tale like retelling.
So that's why I really was like so happy that you chose this book for me or that you recommended it.
I mean it is really, I'm sure there are other examples of unreliable narratives before this book, but this is I think the one that put it into the mainstream as like a narrative device that could be used in the mystery realm. And it's, I mean, it just continues to stand as such a well-done version of that. I think, perhaps whether or not it's the first, it's certainly one of the best done examples. And I think most people don't guess. And I, in fact, I recently recommended this book to a friend of mine for her young son, who's 11, who wanted to start reading some Christie's. He's into mysteries. And she said during the holiday, he was walking around, he was listening to it on audiobook, and he was walking around going, Dr. Shepard, Dr. Shepard. And she was like sharing this with me. And I just thought that was like, to be able to read it again for the first time and find out the ending at 11 years old. I was like, oh, that's
you had
amazing.
Envy.
I just had such envy for his experience. It sounded so wonderful. So now that you've read this one, do you think you're going to read more Christie's?
I think I would.
I gotcha.
I have to say that I find Poirot very irritating.
You do?
Like, I'm sorry. And I know, like, it's just, maybe it's my own snobbery coming out that, like, I don't like.
We are
going
to get so many emails about this.
I know. I'm sorry, guys. I know. I'm just telling my truth. I'm, like, sharing my true feelings with
you. Please direct your anger towards Kate and not to me. No, I'm just kidding.
It was, I think it was like, it's so clever that, and he sort of like wields his cleverness above everyone in such a way that I was like, I don't, like, I feel dumb, honestly. That's, I think, and maybe because I said like, I'm a little bit of a snob as well. I like to be at the center of the like intrigue. I'd like to sort of like be the first one to
Be the Poirot.
And
so then, you're mad at Poirot for being more of a Poirot than you.
Maybe.
Wow. Never heard that one before.
I don't know. Maybe it was just that it was like he clearly had figured it out. And he kind of kept dropping hints that he had figured it out, but he needed to line everything up just to be sure. And he's so meticulous. And like, yes. I appreciate that about him.
Sure.
But I was like, I want the reveal, you know? So I was like, come on, like, let's move it on.
Okay. So you felt like maybe it dragged on a little bit too long.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah.
And it's like a 70,000 word book.
I know, and that's why I feel like such a hypocrite, because like her economy of story is also just incredibly impressive that, you know, like I said at the beginning, like she chooses the exact right words all the time. Mm-hmm. And like, what writer can say that they do that?
Yeah. Like, that's what you're trying to do.
Exactly. I mean,
but often don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's not that I like don't appreciate.
Sure.
I sped through it. It was such a trip. It was such an adventure to read. And I did like find myself really enjoying it, but I was just like, oh
yeah,
like, he's a little annoying.
I think if you're ever wanting a Christie, or in particular a Poirot, where he doesn't drag out the ending, mm-hmm. unfortunately, yeah, that is just not, that's his style. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of lean into that and enjoy it. I do enjoy it. I like, sometimes it's a bit of an eye roll. Like, we recently did our, had our episode about An Appointment with Death, mm-hmm. and that ending scene always makes me laugh because the murderer is not in the room when he does the big reveal. So it's like, why are you doing this? And it kind of, it's a bit silly in that way, but for the most part, I enjoy those big endings. And it also, what I like that it does is, for the reader, it has a satisfying element because he often takes you through every person who could have done it and then why they didn't. Mm. So you kind of get this little retrospective of, maybe things that you missed as a reader going through that would have made it impossible for that person to have been the murderer. And that's quite a nice element that I enjoy.
That's a very good point. I like that.
So, I like those scenes, but I do understand that they could be they're a little bit pompous, mm-hmm. for sure.
I guess, but that's also in line with him.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
So it's like, he is himself. And
he completely is.
Yeah. It was so funny that he like, because again, I mentioned that I didn't like read this going in with any background knowledge. I didn't even read when it was published or anything, because I wanted to see where in the Poirot canon it falls.
Right.
And to realize that it's like an early Poirot.
Yeah, third one.
Yeah. And he's like already trying to be retired. Like... He just wants to garden. He wants to make his vegetable marrows, and then he gets pulled into these things again and again. And I'm like, wow, if he's doing this in 1925, it's gonna be 30 more years of him being like, ugh.
I know. It's so funny. He's like, I mean, I won't say what happens in Curtin, the final book, but he is literally just like, this needs to end.
Yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's a trope of Poirot books in general, that no matter how much he's trying to relax, he will find a murder.
Yeah, exactly.
If he's on holiday, if he's trying to go vegetable marrows, whatever he's doing, murder accompanies. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask you about the other characters in the book, though, because, I mean, we mentioned Caroline, that she's, like, great.
She is.
And doesn't, like, have enough space on the page, I feel. Like, she deserves more space.
Totally.
Because she's just, like, she knows what's going on. She's got that woman's intuition, I would say.
Yeah.
But were there other characters that you really enjoy or actually dislike in this book?
Oh, gosh. I wouldn't say there's anyone I actively dislike. I mean, Ralph is a very, like, kind of over-the-top character, I think, for the purpose of being that very, very red herring.
Yeah.
But he's kind of fun in that way. Roger Ackroyd himself, I think, is kind of, it obviously doesn't get much time because he is famously murdered. And I would have loved to have spent a little bit more time with Mrs. Ferrars.
Yeah.
Because I think she's obviously has a lot of depth to her and has, I think that would have been more interesting to have seen a bit more of Ackroyd's and Mrs. Furr's relationship and develop that a little bit more. But again, it's such a short book and it's written in such short strokes that I think to add any more, you have to you're adding chapters, right? You're adding whole other elements to the story. So this one really keeps it moving.
It's true. And especially if you had, you know, like five possible people basically that could have committed the murder, you can't really spend a lot of time on the character development unless it's like fully crucial to their whereabouts.
Correct.
That night.
Correct. What do you, what about you? Do you have what characters you would have liked to have seen
more? I really like Parker intrigued me because like he was so like chop chop, like always, you know, like professional and kind of like there, but I could feel that there was like a hint of, oh, I'm trying to like be a little bit gossipy. I kind of want to know what's happening behind closed doors. So I'll like lean into, you know, the study door and try to like eavesdrop a little bit, but I don't think he would ever admit it really. That's what it seemed like. And I was like, this guy seems like he has a little bit of depth.
Yeah. And that's also something that Christy, I think, plays with a lot is like, how like the domestic people within the house interact with the people who own the house and kind of, that they're, are they listening at doors? It's something often if it's brought up that they're very insulted by there, but they still are kind of listening.
Right.
And it makes a lot of sense. Like if you're living in a house and this is like the drama that's going on around you, you want to know what's happening. Right. So that's something that comes up again and again. And I think it's very present.
Totally. Definitely the upstairs, downstairs. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was also thinking of our first episode we ever did with Stuart Turton.
Yes.
Because he had also said that he tried to write a Christie and then realized that all Christies were already written.
So yeah, she wrote them all. Yeah.
Right. But there was a lot of elements of her in his book after having read The Murder of Roger Ackroyd and feeling this sort of like, okay, there's, you know, five or six different people from different class levels in this manner.
Right.
Moving about the house.
Right.
And it just had like very similar elements that I was like, Stuart, I see you. Great job. Right?
That's the 7.5 deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Yes. And I definitely recommend that one. Mm-hmm. And it's a great kind of wonky version of Christie.
Yes.
Kate, I want to say thank you so much for being on the podcast and reading a Christie so that you can grow with me as we continue to do Tea and Murder together.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
This was fun.
Listeners, you will probably not hear my voice again for another season.
No, we're going to hear your voice again. Would you recommend this one for people who haven't read a Christie necessarily to start with?
I would, yeah.
You would?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so. It sounds like it, or from what I have known now, listening to two seasons of this podcast and helping to produce it, it sounds like it is the epitome of like a well-done Christie whodunit. Yes.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And if you were going to recommend that listeners start with an episode of this podcast, where would you recommend they start?
Oh, that's a very good question.
Thank you. I am the host of Tea and Murder and I get the podcast.
Oh, you put me on the spot.
I know I did. I'm sorry.
I have to say I start at the beginning.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stuart Turton.
That's a good episode.
We have so many good, it depends on what you like. Like, are you really into, you know, dissecting the murders? Then that is a great episode. If you're more into sort of like craft, then maybe, we have so many episodes with great authors like Rachel Housel Hall.
Yes.
Excellent episode. Martha Jocelyn, who has based her young adult fiction on Agatha Christie as well.
Yeah.
So it's really like, do you want a fully different take than maybe talking about jewelry and Agatha Christie, Levi Higgs? Like there's so many different ways you can go with it. So I can't really recommend just one except to start at the beginning.
Yeah, I think that's the way to go. It is nice that you can jump around as you like. And I think one of my favorites is the episode with Robin Stevens on Halloween Party.
Yes.
That's such a good episode. And she is such an interesting author and her perspective is just really good. So I always like to suggest that one as well.
Great.
Thanks again for being here. And to all of our listeners, thanks for sticking around between seasons. We have a really exciting season 3 coming up for you, so stay tuned for that. And in the meantime, we love to hear from you. So you can always reach out to me at teaandmurderpodcast@gmail.com with any of your thoughts. Keep your criticisms constructive, please.
Come at me, y'all. It's okay. I don't mind.
No, we love to hear from you. So thank you for listening and thanks for being here, Kate.
Yeah, thank you. See you next season.
Okay, bye. Thank you to our producer, Kate Kreshel, and our sound engineer, Winter Robinson. To stay up to date and get some extra fun info, you can follow us on Instagram at Tea and Murder. Rating and reviewing us really helps, so please do that if you feel so inclined. We're on all your favorite podcast platforms. Please remember to follow us there and recommend us to anyone you think might need a little tea and/or murder in their lives. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Tea and Murder.